And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading, and we've been reading Ivanhoe, Sir Walter Scott. And we're at the point where Garth has taken on, well, it would appear to be a bandit who seems intent on taking his money. But before we do, a word from our sponsors.
Braidwood Butchery. High-quality meats and old-fashioned friendly service. And they also smoke all their own deli range on the premises and are open 5.5 days a week. Braidwood Butchery, 137 Wallace Street, Braidwood, 4842 2472. A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Veterinary Surgery has been providing high-quality veterinary services to Braidwood and the surrounds since 1989. Their veterinarians have extensive knowledge of preventative and diagnostic health of all species, no matter how large or small. They're open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, and Saturdays, 9 till noon. You can call them on 48 42 2697, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Braidwood's Half-Cut Barber is now open at the Braidwood Hotel, offering traditional grooming services for the men of Braidwood. Walk-ins are welcome. Contact Half-Cut Barber Braidwood through their webpage. Proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors. They really do make our little station possible. And on with Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. So saying, the two champions closed together, and for a few minutes they displayed greater quality in strength, courage, and skill, intercepting and returning the blows of their adversary with the most rapid dexterity, while from the continued clatter of their weapons, a person at a distance might have supposed that there were at least six persons engaged on each side. Less obstinate, and even less dangerous combats, have been described in good heroic verse, but that of Garth and the Miller must remain unsung, for want of a sacred poet to do justice to its eventful progress. Yet, though a quarterstaff play be out of date, what we can in prose we will do for these bold champions. Long they fought, until the Miller began to lose temper at finding himself so stoutly opposed, and at hearing the laughter of his companions, who, as usual in such cases, enjoyed his vexation. This was not a state of mind favourable to the noble game of quarterstaff, in which, as in ordinary cudgel playing, the utmost coolness is requisite. And it gave Garth, whose temper was steady, though surly, the opportunity of acquiring a decided advantage, in availing himself of which he displayed great mastery. The Miller pressed furiously forward, dealing blows with either end of his weapon alternately, and striving to come to half-staff distance, while Garth defended himself against the attack, keeping his hands about a yard asunder, and covering himself by shifting his weapon with great celerity, so as to protect his head and body. Thus did he maintain the defensive, making his eye, foot, and hand keep true time, until, observing his antagonist lose wind, he darted the staff at his face with the thrust. He slid his hand, right hand, down to his left, and with the full swing of the weapon struck his opponent on the left side of the head, who instantly measured his length upon the greensward.
"Well and yeomanly done!" shouted the robbers. "Fair play, and old England for ever! The Saxon hath saved both his purse and his hide, and the Miller has met his match."
"Thou mayst go thy ways, my friend," said the captain, addressing Garth in special confirmation of the general voice, "and I will cause two of my comrades to guide thee by the best way to your master's pavilion, and to guard you from night walkers that might have less tender consciences than ours, for there is many one of them upon the amble in such a night as this. Take heed, however," he added sternly, "remember thou hast refused to tell thy name. Ask not after ours, nor endeavour to discover who or what we are, for if you make such an attempt, you will come by worse fortune than has yet befallen you." Garth thanked the captain for his courtesy, and promised to attend to his recommendation. two of the outlaws, taking up their quarterstaffs and desiring Garth to follow close in the rear, walked roundly forward along a bypath which traversed the thicket and the broken ground adjacent to it. On the very verge of the thicket, two men spoke to his conductors and, receiving an answer in a whisper, withdrew into the wood and suffered them to pass unmolested. This circumstance induced Garth to believe that the gang was strong in numbers and that they kept regular guards around their place of rendezvous. When they arrived on the open heath, where Garth might have had some trouble in finding his road, the thieves guided him straight forward to the top of a little eminence, where he could see spread beneath him, in the moonlight, the palisades of the lists, the glimmering pavilions pitched at either end, with the pennons which adorned them fluttering in the moonbeam, and from which could be heard the hum of the song with which the sentinels were beguiling their night watch. Here the thieves stopped. "We go with you no further," said they. "It were not safe that we should do so. Remember the warning you received. Keep secret what has happened this night to you, and you will have no room to repent it. Neglect what is now told you, and the Tower of London shall not protect you against our revenge." "Good night to you, kind sirs," said Garth. "I shall remember your orders, and trust that there is no offence in wishing you a safer and honester trade." So they parted, the outlaws returning in the direction from whence they had come, and Garth proceeding to the tent of his master, to whom, notwithstanding the injunction he had received, he communicated the whole adventures of the evening. The disinherited knight was filled with astonishment, no less at the generosity of Rebecca, by which, however, he resolved he would not profit, than that of the robbers, to whose profession such a quality seemed totally foreign. His course of reflections upon these singular circumstances was, however, interrupted by the necessity for taking repose, which the fatigue of the preceding day and the propriety of refreshing himself for the morrow's encounter rendered alike indispensable. The knight, therefore, stretched himself for repose upon a rich couch with which the tent was provided, and the faithful Garth, extending his hardy limbs upon a bearskin which formed a sort of carpet to the pavilion, laid himself across the opening of the tent so that no one could enter without awakening him. Chapter 12. The morning arose in unclouded splendour, and ere the sun was much above the horizon, the idlest or the most eager of the spectators appeared on the common, moving to the lists as to a general centre, in order to secure a favourable situation for viewing the continuation of the expected games. The marshals and their attendants appeared next on the field, together with the heralds, for the purpose of receiving the names of the knights who intended to joust, with which side each chose to join. This was a necessary precaution in order to secure equality between the two bodies who should be opposed to each other. According to due formality, the disinherited knight was to be considered as leader of the one body, while Brian de Bois-Guilbert, who had been rated as having done second best in the preceding day, was named first champion of the other band. Those who had concurred in the challenge adhered to his party, of course, excepting only Ralph de Vipont, who his fall had rendered unfit so soon to put on his armour. There was no want of distinguished and noble candidates to fill up the ranks on either side. In fact, the general tournament, in which all knights fought at once, was more dangerous than single encounters. They were, nevertheless, more frequented and practised by the chivalry of the age. Many knights who had not sufficient confidence in their own skill to defy a single adversary of high reputation were nevertheless desirous of displaying their valour in the general combat, where they might meet others with whom they were more upon an equality. On the present occasion, about 50 knights were inscribed as desirous of combating upon each side, when the marshals declared that no more could be admitted, to the disappointment of several who were too late in preferring their claim to be included. At the hour of 10 o'clock, the whole plain was crowded with horsemen, horsewomen, and foot passengers hastening to the tournament, and shortly after a grand flourish of trumpets announced Prince John and his retinue, attended by many of those knights who meant to take share in the game, as well as others who had no such intention. About the same time arrived Cedric the Saxon, with the Lady Rowena unattended, however, by Athelstane. This Saxon lord had arrayed his tall and strong person in armour in order to take his place among the combatants, and, considerably to the surprise of Cedric, had chosen to enlist himself on the part of the Knight Templar. The Saxon, indeed, had remonstrated strongly with his friend upon the injudicious choice he had made of his party, but he had only received that sort of answer usually given by those who are more obstinate in following their own course than strong in justifying it. His best, if not his only reason, for adhering to the party of Brian de Bois-Guilbert, Athelstane had the prudence to keep to himself, though his apathy of disposition prevented his taking any means to recommend himself to the Lady Rowena. He was, nevertheless, by no means insensible to her charms, and considered his union with her as a matter already fixed beyond doubt by the assent of Cedric and her other friends. It had therefore been with smothered displeasure that the proud though indolent Lord Königsberg beheld the victor of the preceding day select Rowena as the object of that honour which it became his privilege to confer. In order to punish him for a preference which seemed to interfere with his own suit, Athelstane, confident of his strength, and to whom his flatterers at least ascribed great skill in arms, had determined not only to deprive the disinherited knight of his powerful succour, but, if an opportunity should occur, to make him feel the weight of his battle-axe. De Bracy and the other knights attached to Prince John, in obedience to a hint from him, had joined the party of the challengers, John being desirous to secure, if possible, the victory of that side. On the other hand, many knights, both English and Norman, natives and strangers, took part against the challengers, the more readily that the opposite band was to be led by so distinguished a champion as the disinherited knight had approved himself to be. As soon as Prince John observed that the destined queen of the day had arrived upon the field, assuming that air of courtesy which sat well upon him when he was pleased to exhibit it, he rode forward to meet her, doffed his bonnet, and alighting from his horse, assisted the Lady Rowena from her saddle, while his followers uncovered at the same time, and one of the most distinguished dismounted to hold her palfrey. "It is thus," said Prince John, "that we set the dutiful example of loyalty to the Queen of Love and Beauty, and are ourselves her guide to the throne, which she must this day occupy. Ladies," he said, "attend your queen as you wish in your turn to be distinguished by like honours." So saying, the prince marshalled Rowena to the seat of honour opposite his own, while the fairest and most distinguished ladies present crowded after her to obtain places as near as possible to their temporary sovereign. No sooner was Rowena seated than a burst of music, half drowned by the shouts of the multitude, greeted her new dignity. Meantime the sun shone fierce and bright upon the polished arms of the knights of either side, who crowded the opposite extremities of the list and held eager conference together concerning the best mode of arranging their line of battle and supporting the conflict. The heralds then proclaimed silence until the laws of the tourney should be rehearsed. These were calculated in some degree to abate the dangers of the day, a precaution the more necessary as the conflict was to be maintained with sharp swords and pointed lances. The champions were therefore prohibited to thrust with sword and were confined to striking. A knight, it was announced, might use a mace or a battle axe at pleasure, but the dagger was a prohibited weapon. A knight unhorsed might renew the fight on foot with any other on the opposite side in the same predicament, but mounted horsemen were in that case forbidden to assail him. When any knight could force his antagonist to the proximity of the lists so as to touch the extreme palisade at the other end with his person or arms, such opponent was obliged to yield himself as vanquished, and his armour and horse were placed at the disposal of the conqueror. A knight thus overcome was not permitted to take further share in the combat. If any combatant was struck down and unable to recover his feet, his squire or page might enter the lists and drag his master out of the press. But in that case the knight was adjudged vanquished and his arms and horse declared forfeited. The combat was to cease as soon as Prince John should throw down his leading staff or truncheon, another precaution usually taken to prevent the unnecessary effusion of blood by the too long endurance of a sport so desperate. Any knight breaking the rules of the tournament, or otherwise transgressing the rules of honourable chivalry, was liable to be stripped of his arms and, having his shield reversed, to be placed in that posture astride upon the bars of the palisade, and exposed to public derision in punishment for his unknightly conduct. Having announced these precautions, the heralds concluded with an exhortation to each good knight to do his duty and to merit favour from the Queen of Beauty and Love. This proclamation having been made, the heralds withdrew to their stations. The knights, entering at either end of the lists in long procession, arranged themselves in a double file, precisely opposite to each other, the leader of each party being in the centre of the foremost rank, a post which he did not occupy until each had carefully arranged the ranks of his party and stationed everyone in his place. It was a goodly and, at the same time, an anxious sight. To behold so many gallant champions, mounted bravely and armed richly, stand ready, prepared for an encounter so formidable, seated on their war saddles, like so many pillars of iron, and awaiting the signal of encounter with the same ardour as their generous steeds, which, by neighing and pawing the ground, gave signal of their impatience. And yet, the knights held their long lances upright, their bright points glancing to the sun, and the streamers with which they were decorated fluttering over the plumage of the helmets. Thus they remained while the marshals of the field surveyed their ranks with the utmost exactness, lest either party had more or fewer than the appointed number. The tale was found exactly complete. The marshals then withdrew from the lists, and William de Wierville, with a voice of thunder, pronounced the signal words, "Laissez aller!" The trumpets sounded as he spoke. The spears of the champions were at once lowered and placed in the rests. The spurs were dashed into the flanks of the horses, and the two foremost ranks of either party rushed upon each other in full gallop and met in the middle of the lists with a shock, the sound of which was heard at a mile's distance. The rear rank of each party advanced at a slower pace to sustain the defeated and follow up the successes of the victors of their party. The consequences of the encounter were not instantly seen, for the dust raised by the trampling of so many steeds darkened the air, and it was a minute ere the anxious spectators could see the fate of the encounter. When the fight became visible, half the knights on each side were dismounted, some by the dexterity of their adversary's lance, some by the superior weight and strength of opponents, which had borne down both horse and man. Some lay stretched on the earth as if never more to rise. Some had already gained their feet and were closing hand to hand with those of their antagonists who were in the same predicament. And several on both sides who had received wounds by which they were disabled were stopping their blood with scarves and endeavouring to extricate themselves from the tumult. The mounted knights, whose lances had been almost all broken by the fury of the encounter, were now closely engaged with their swords, shouting their war cries and exchanging buffets as if honour and life depended on the issue of the combat. The tumult was presently increased by the advance of the second rank on either side, which, acting as a reserve, now rushed on to aid their companions. The followers of Brian de Bois-Guilbert shouted, "Ha! Bossion! Bossion!" Bossion was the name of the Templar's banner, which was half black, half white, to intimate, it is said, that they were candid and fair towards Christians, but black and terrible towards infidels. "For the temple! For the temple!" they called. The opposite party shouted in answer, "Dedicado! Dedicado!" which watchword they took from the motto upon their leader's shield, "Disinherited." The champions thus encountered each other with the utmost fury and with alternate success. The tide of battle seemed to flow now toward the southern, now toward the northern extremity of the lists, as the one or the other party prevailed. Meantime, the clang of the blows and the shouts of the combatants mixed fearfully with the sound of the trumpets and drowned the groans of those who fell and lay rolling defenceless beneath the feet of the horses. The splendid armour of the combatants was now defaced with dust and blood, and gave way at every stroke of the sword and the battle-axe. The gay plumage shorn from the crests drifted upon the breeze like snowflakes. All that was beautiful and graceful in the martial array had disappeared, and what was now visible was only calculated to awake terror or compassion. Yet such is the force of habit that not only the vulgar spectators, who are naturally attracted by sights of horror, but even the ladies of distinction, who crowded the galleries, saw the conflict with thrilling interest, certainly, but without a wish to withdraw their eyes from a sight so terrible. Here and there, indeed, a fair cheek might turn pale, or a faint scream might be heard, as a lover, a brother, or a husband was struck from his horse. But in general, the ladies around encouraged the combatants, not by clapping their hands and waving their veils and handkerchiefs, but even by exclaiming, "Brave lance, good sword," when any successful thrust or blow took place under their observation. Such being the interest taken by the fair sex in this bloody game, that of the men is the more easily understood. It showed itself in loud exclamations upon every change of fortune, while all eyes were riveted on the lists, that the spectators seemed as if they themselves had dealt and received the blows which were there so fiercely bestowed. And between every pause was heard the voice of the heralds, exclaiming, "Fight on, brave knights! Man dies, but glory lives! Fight on! Death is better than defeat! Fight on, brave knights! For bright eyes behold your deeds!" Amid the varied fortunes of the combat, the eyes of all endeavoured to discover the leaders of each band, who, mingling in the thick of the fight, encouraged their companions both by voice and example. Both displayed great feats of gallantry, nor did either Bois Guilbert or the Disinherited Knight find in the ranks opposed to them a champion who could be termed their unquestioned match. They repeatedly endeavoured to single out each other, spurred by mutual animosity and aware that the fall of either leader might be considered as decisive of victory. Such, however, was the crowd and the confusion that during the earlier part of the conflict their efforts to meet were unavailing, and they were repeatedly separated by the eagerness of their followers, each of whom was anxious to win honour by measuring his strength against the leader of the opposite party. But when the field became thin by the numbers on either side who had yielded themselves, vanquished, had been compelled to the extremity of the lists, or been otherwise rendered incapable of continuing the strife, the Templar and the Disinherited Knight at length encountered hand to hand with all the fury that mortal animosity joined to rivalry of honour could inspire. Such was the address of each in parrying and striking that the spectators broke forth into a unanimous and involuntary shout expressive of their delight and admiration. But at this moment the party of the Disinherited Knight had the worst. The gigantic arm of Front de Boeuf on the one flank and the ponderous strength of Asselstein on the other, bearing down and dispersing those immediately exposed to them. Finding themselves freed from their immediate antagonists, it seems to have occurred to both these knights at the same instant that they would render the most decisive advantage to their party by aiding the Templar in his contest with his rival. Turning their horses, therefore, at the same moment, the Norman spurred against the Disinherited Knight on the one side and the Saxon on the other. It was utterly impossible that the object of this unequal or unexpected assault could have sustained it, had he not been warned by a general cry from the spectators, who could not but take interest in one exposed to such disadvantage. "Beware, beware, Sir Disinherited!" was shouted so universally that the knight became aware of his danger, and striking a full blow at the Templar, he reined back his steed in the same moment so as to escape the charge of Athelstane and Front de Boeuf. These knights, therefore, their aim being thus eluded, rushed from opposite sides betwixt the object of their attack and the Templar, almost running their horses against each other ere they could stop their career. Recovering their horses, however, and wheeling them around, the whole three pursued their united purpose of bearing to the earth the Disinherited Knight. Nothing could have saved him, except the remarkable strength and activity of the noble horse which he had won on the preceding day. This stood him in the more stead, as the horse of Bois Guilbert was wounded, and those of Front de Boeuf and Athelstane were both tired with the weight of their gigantic masters, clad in complete armour, and with the preceding exertions of the day. The masterly horsemanship of the Disinherited Knight, and the activity of the noble animal which he mounted, enabled him for a few minutes to keep at sword's point his three antagonists, turning and wheeling with the agility of a hawk upon the wing, keeping his enemies as far separate as he could, and rushing now against the one, now against the other, dealing sweeping blows with his sword, without waiting to receive those which were aimed at him in turn. But although the lists rang with the applause of his dexterity, it was evident that he must at last be overpowered. And the nobles around Prince John implored him with one voice to throw down his warder and to so save so brave a knight from the disgrace of being overcome by odds.
"Not I, by the light of heaven," answered Prince John. "This same springal, who conceals his name and despises our proffered hospitality, has already gained one prize and may now afford to let others have their turn."
As he spoke thus, an unexpected incident changed the fortune of the day. There was amongst the ranks of the disinherited knight a champion in black armour, mounted on a black horse, large of size, tall, and to all appearance powerful and strong, like the rider by whom he was mounted. This knight, who bore on his shield no device of any kind, had hitherto evinced very little interest in the event of the fight, beating off with seeming ease those combatants who attacked him, but neither pursuing his advantages nor himself assailing anyone. In short, he had hitherto acted the part rather of a spectator than of a party in the tournament, a circumstance which procured him among the spectators the name of Le Noir Fainéant, or the Black Sluggard. At once this knight seemed to throw aside his apathy when he discovered the leader of his party so hard bestead, for, setting spurs to his horse, which was quite fresh, he came to his assistance like a thunderbolt, exclaiming in a voice like a trumpet call, "Dedichado, Dedichado, to the rescue!" It was high time, for while the disinherited knight was pressing upon the Templar, Front de Boeuf had got nigh to him with his uplifted sword, but ere the blow could descend, the sable knight dealt a stroke on the head, which, glancing from the polished helmet, lighted with violence scarcely abated on the chamfron of the steed, and Front de Boeuf rolled on the ground, both horse and man, equally stunned by the fury of the blow. Le Noir Fainéant then turned his horse upon Athelstane of Königsberg, and, his own sword having been broken in his encounter with Front de Boeuf, he wrenched from the hand of the bulky Saxon the battle-axe which he wielded, and, like one familiar with the use of the weapon, bestowed him such a blow upon the crest that Athelstane also lay senseless on the field. Having achieved this double feat, for which he was the more highly applauded, that it was totally unexpected of him, the knight seemed to resume his sluggishness of character, returning calmly to the northern extremity of the lists, leaving his leader to cope as he best could with Brian de Bois-Guilbert. This was no longer a matter of so much difficulty as formerly. The Templar's horse had bled much and gave way under the shock of the disinherited knight's charge. Brian de Bois-Guilbert rolled on the field, encumbered with the stirrup from which he was unable to draw his foot. His antagonist sprung from horseback, waved his fatal sword over the head of his adversary, and commanded him to yield himself. When Prince John, more moved by the Templar's dangerous situation than he had been by that of his rival, saved him the mortification of confessing himself vanquished by casting down his warder and putting an end to the conflict. It was indeed only the relics and embers of the fight which continued to burn, for, of the few knights who still continued in the lists, the greater part had, by tacit consent, forborne the conflict for some time, leaving it to be determined by the strife of the leaders. The squires, who had found it a matter of danger and difficulty to attend their masters during the engagement, now thronged into the lists to pay their dutiful attendance to the wounded, who were removed with the utmost care and attention to the neighbouring pavilions or to the quarters prepared for them in the adjoining village. Thus ended the memorable field of Ashby de la Zouche, one of the most gallantly contested tournaments of that age, for although only four knights, including one who was smothered by the heat of his armour, had died upon the field, yet upwards of 30 were desperately wounded, four or five of whom never recovered. Several more were disabled for life, and those who escaped best carried the marks of the conflict to the grave with them. Hence it was always mentioned in the old records as the gentle and joyous passage of arms of Ashby. It being now the duty of Prince John to name the knight who had done best, he determined that the honour of the day remained with the knight whom the popular voice had termed Le Noir Fainéant. It was pointed out to the prince, in the impeachment of his decree, that the victory had been in fact won by the disinherited knight, who in the course of the day had overcome six champions with his own hand, and who had finally unhorsed and struck down the leader of the opposite party. but Prince John adhered to his own opinion on the ground that the disinherited knight and his party had lost the day. But for the powerful assistance of the Knight of the Black Armour, to whom therefore he persisted in awarding the prize. To the surprise of those present, however, the knight thus preferred was nowhere to be found. He had left the lists immediately when the conflict ceased, and had been observed by some spectators to move down one of the forest glades with the same slow pace and listless and indifferent manner which had procured him the epithet of the Black Sluggard. After he had been summoned twice by sound of trumpet and proclamation of the heralds, it became necessary to name another to receive the honours which he had been assigned. Prince John had now no further excuse for resisting the claim of the disinherited knight, whom therefore he named the champion of the day. Through a field slippery with blood and encumbered with broken armour and the bodies of slain and wounded horses, the marshals of the lists again conducted the victor to the foot of Prince John's throne. "Disinherited knight," said Prince John, "since by that title only you will consent to be known to us, we a second time award to you the honours of this tournament, and announce to you your right to claim and receive from the hands of the Queen of Love and Beauty the chaplet of honour which your valour has justly deserved." The knight bowed low and gracefully, but returned no answer. While the trumpets sounded, while the heralds strained their voices in proclaiming honour to the brave and glory the victor, while ladies waved their silken handkerchiefs and embroidered veils, and while all ranks joined in a clamorous shout of exultation, the marshals conducted the disinherited knight across the lists to the foot of that throne of honour which was occupied by the Lady Rowena. On the lowest step of this throne, the champion was made to kneel down. Indeed, his whole action since the fight had ended seemed rather to have been upon the impulse of those around him than from his own free will, and it was observed that he tottered as they guided him the second time across the lists. Rowena, descending from her station with a graceful and dignified step, was about to place the chaplet which she held in her hand upon the helmet of the champion, when the marshals exclaimed with one voice, "It must not be thus! His head must be bare!" The knight muttered faintly a few words, which were lost in the hollow of his helmet, but their purport seemed to be a desire that his casque might not be removed. Whether from love of form or from curiosity, the marshals paid no attention to his expressions of reluctance, but unhelmed him by cutting the laces of his casque and undoing the fastening of his gorget. When the helmet was removed, the well-formed yet sunburnt features of a young man of 25 was seen amidst a profusion of short hair. His countenance was as pale as death, and marked in one or two places with streaks of blood. Rowena had no sooner beheld him than she uttered a faint shriek, but at once summoning up the energy of her disposition and compelling herself, as it were, to proceed while her frame yet trembled with the violence of sudden emotion, she placed upon the drooping head of the victor the splendid chaplet which was the destined reward of the day, and pronounced in a clear and distinct tone these words, "I bestow on thee this chaplet, Sir Knight, as the meed of valour assigned to this day's victor." Here she paused a moment, and then firmly added, "And upon brows more worthy could a wreath of chivalry never be placed." The knight stooped his head and kissed the hand of the lovely sovereign by whom his valour had been rewarded, and then, sinking yet further forward, lay prostrate at her feet. There was a general consternation. Cedric, who had been struck mute by the sudden appearance of his banished son, now rushed forward as if to separate him from Rowena. But this had been already accomplished by the marshals of the field, who, guessing the cause of Ivanhoe's swoon, had hastened to undo his armour and found that the head of a lance had penetrated his breastplate and inflicted a wound in his side. Chapter 13. The name of Ivanhoe was no sooner pronounced than it flew from mouth to mouth with all the celerity with which eagerness could convey and curiosity receive it. It was not long ere it reached the circle of the prince, whose brow darkened as he heard the news. Looking around him, however, with an air of scorn, And my lords, said he, and especially you, Sir Prior, what think ye of the doctrine the learned tell us concerning innate attractions and antipathies? Methinks that I felt the presence of my brother's minion even when I least guessed from yonder suit of armour enclosed. Front de Boeuf must prepare to restore his fief of Avenhoe, said de Bracy, who, having discharged his part honourably in the tournament, had laid his shield and helmet aside, and again mingled with the prince's retinue. Aye, answered Waldemar Fitzurse, this gallant is likely to reclaim the castle and manor which Richard assigned to him, and which your highness's generosity has since given to Front de Boeuf. Front de Boeuf, replied John, is a man more willing to swallow three manors such as Ivanhoe than to disgorge one of them. For the rest, sirs, I hope none here will deny my right to confer the fiefs of the crown upon the faithful followers who are around me, and ready to perform the usual military service in the room of those who have wandered to foreign countries, and can neither render homage nor service when called upon. The audience were too much interested in the question not to pronounce the prince's assumed right altogether indubitable. A generous prince, a most noble lord, who thus takes upon himself the task of rewarding faithful followers. Such were the words which burst from the train, expectants all of them of similar grants at the expense of King Richard's followers and favourites, if indeed they had not as yet received such. Prior Aymer also assented to the general proposition, observing, however, that the blessed Jerusalem could not indeed be termed a foreign country. She was communis mater, the mother of all Christians. But he saw not, he declared, how the knight of Ivanhoe could plead any advantage from this, since he, the prior, was assured that the crusaders under Richard had never proceeded much farther than Ascalon, which, as all the world knew, was a town of the Philistines, and entitled to none of the privileges of the holy city. Waldemar, whose curiosity had led him towards the place where Ivanhoe had fallen to the ground, now returned. The gallant, said he, is likely to give your highness little disturbance, and to leave Front de Boeuf in the quiet possession of his gains. He is severely wounded. Whatever becomes of him, said Prince John, he is victor of the day, and were he tenfold our enemy, or the devoted friend of our brother, which is perhaps the same, his wounds must be looked to. Our own physician shall attend him. A stern smile curled the prince's lip as he spoke. Waldemar Fitzurse hastened to reply that Ivanhoe was already removed from the lists and in the custody of his friends. I was somewhat afflicted, he said, to see the grief of the Queen of Love and Beauty, whose sovereignty of a day this event has changed into mourning. I'm not a man to be moved by a woman's lament for her lover, but this same Lady Rowena suppressed her sorrow with such dignity of manner that it could only be discovered by her folded hands and her tearless eye, which trembled as it remained fixed on the lifeless form before her. "Who is this Lady Rowena?" said Prince John, "of whom we have heard so much." "Nor a Saxon heiress of large possession," replied the prior. "A rose of loveliness and a jewel of wealth, the fairest among a thousand, a bundle of myrrh and a cluster of camphor." We shall cheer her sorrows, said Prince John, and amend her blood by wedding her to a Norman. She seems a minor, and must therefore be at our royal disposal in marriage. How sayest thou, De Bracy? What thinkst thou of gaining fair lands and livings by wedding a Saxon after the fashion of the followers of the Conqueror? If the lands are to my liking, my lord, answered De Bracy, it will be hard to displease me with a bride, and deeply will I hold myself bound to your highness for a good deed, which will fulfil all the promises made in favour of your servant and your vassal. We will not forget it, said Prince John, and that we may instantly go to work, command our seneschal presently to order the attendance of the Lady Rowena and her company, that is, the rude churl, her guardian, and the Saxon ox whom the Black Knight struck down in the tournament upon his evening's banquet. De Bigot, he added, to his seneschal, thou wilt word this second summons so courteously as to gratify the pride of these Saxons, and make it impossible for them to again refuse, although by the bones of Becket, courtesy to them is casting pearls before swine. Well, that's our book reading for this week. Who was the Black Knight? That's an interesting question. And who was the robber captain? An even more interesting question. And what of Prince John? And what of Isaac? Have they raised the ransom? Is the King Richard free? We'll find out next week. Until then, Braidwood, keep well, keep happy.
Alone.